Thanks for joining us for today's edition of the Portland Christian Center podcast. This week, Pastor Ray Noah continued our series, Extra Grace Required, with a message titled, The Martyr. Now here's Pastor Ray.
How many of you would say, this week I was mistreated or I was not appreciated in the way that I should have been? Show of hands on this. This week I was mistreated and I was not appreciated. And I let my feelings be known about that. I told the person that mistreated me, or I told somebody else about being mistreated. Well, if you raised your hand, or if you should have raised your hands, congratulations. You may just be an EGR personality type that we call the martyr. The martyr. We're going to talk about that today. You know, at times we've all felt that way, haven't we? Unappreciated, underappreciated, mistreated. We've all felt that way. And it could be true. It could be that we literally were not appreciated this is the way in a way that we should have been, or we had been mistreated by someone. It could have been true. Or it might have just been our perception. Not reality, but it was our perception. And as you know, perception is reality. But healthy people don't get stuck in that. So we all kind of experience that, the sense of being a martyr at times, but healthy people don't get stuck there. But for the one who lives with a martyr complex, the EGR, extra grace required personality type that we call the martyr complex or the martyr, those feelings become chronic self-pity. Chronic self-pity. And chronic self-pity always turns to pessimism, which turns to complaint, which turns to manipulation. And that's kind of the journey of the martyr, right? It becomes chronic self-pity. I feel sorry for myself. And when I feel sorry for myself, I kind of get a darkened view of the world. And I begin to gripe and whine and complain about it. I talk to others about my upset or my mistreatment or my, you know, the lack of appreciation that people have toward me. And that then will turn to manipulation. I will begin to maneuver things, maneuver people, maneuver situations in order to get people to respond to me in the way that I feel that I should be treated. But that leads to a twofold problem. I want to talk to you about the twofold problem of the martyr. One, it doesn't work. That never works. Pessimism and complaint and manipulation never works. Have you ever met someone who complained their way into appreciation, being appreciated? Have you ever met a griper who just, people's love for them grew and grew and grew? It doesn't work. Have you ever met someone who's maneuvering and manipulating to get you to love them and to compliment them? That really ever works? It just doesn't work. That's problem number one. Problem number two is nobody likes a martyr. Nobody likes a martyr. Mark Twain said, don't complain about all your problems. 80% of the people don't care. The other 20% think you deserve it anyway. So don't complain, right? Well, call them what you will. Call them a pessimist or a whiner or a victim. Victimization is a big deal these days. Someone wrote a book called A Nation of Victims. And when you look around today, you find a big part of our society is living as if they're a victim of circumstances. It's somebody else's fault. I'm not responsible. Things are going bad for me and it's not me. Whatever you want to call them, the martyr is not a winning personality trait. Frankly, a martyr, someone with a martyr complex, that is not a winning personality trait. So we're going to talk about that today. So years ago, I was in a small group, men's small group, and not the one I'm in right now, but years ago, and for whatever reason, I came in that morning, and I was just griping. I was complaining about, I was just whining about something. I don't even remember what it was, but I remember what happened, because there was a guy in the group that had listened for as long as he could, and he finally just blurted out, he said, oh, hey, pal, why don't you just build a bridge and get over it? I thought, how insensitive. I'm your pastor. You're supposed to listen to me. You're supposed to encourage me. But you know what? The more that I thought about it, the more I thought, you know what? He's right. He's right. I mean, that's a better way to live. Just build a bridge, whatever you're building a bridge over, and get over it, get past it. Because, after all, 80% of the people don't care, and the other 20% think I deserve it anyway. So I've actually embraced that. That is now one of my life principles. I have several of them. That is one of them, that when things don't go my way, what am I going to do? I'm going to build a bridge and get over it. Build a bridge and get over it. So we're going to talk about that today. I want you to turn, if you would, in your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 19. We've been in 1 and 2 Samuel looking at King David, and now we're going to look at one of the great prophets of the Old Testament, the prophet Elijah, the prophet of fire. And I think characteristically, he was not a martyr. He didn't suffer from martyr complex. But in chapter 19, he sinks into a martyr syndrome, a martyr complex. And so we want to look at that, and because it's going to show us how to build bridges from a martyr complex to an optimistic view of life. Now, let me just stop here and try to flatten this out a little bit, because I think all of us have a little bit of a martyr complex that we go through from time to time. All of us have a little bit of martyr within us. I mean, because after all, we do whine and complain, and we feel unappreciated at times. So all of us struggle with that from time to time. Some of you may be a chronic martyr, and this one is definitely for you. But we also have people in our lives that suffer from that. And so I want to challenge you today, as you think about this, that you not only think about it for your own life, but you think about it in terms of the people that you interact with, perhaps on a weekly, if not a daily basis. I especially want to challenge you if you are in influence and authority over someone, that you would begin to say, hey, how can I help this person? Because that personality type is not a winning personality. There's not a winning personality. So if you're a coach, if you're a teacher, if you're a youth pastor, if you're a parent or a grandparent, especially, because we do live in an age, a culture of complaint. We do live in a nation of victims these days. And I believe that the family of God, the church of God, is to admonish and exhort one another. And so when we find one of our brothers or one of our family members sinking into this syndrome, we would say, hey, listen up. This is not a winning strategy for you, and help them out. So we can encourage and exhort one another to grow from the martyr complex, the martyr syndrome, into an optimistic or a faith-filled view of life. So 1 Kings chapter 19, we're going to read verses 1 through 10. This is a great story. Verse 1, Ahab told Jezebel how Elijah had killed all the false prophets. Now let me just pause here and talk to you about the setting, the historical setting for this. The story really it takes place over several chapters in 1 Kings, chapter 17, chapter 18, 19, 20. It really centers around the life and ministry of Elijah. During this time, King Ahab, ruled over the northern tribes of Israel, over the nation called Israel. There was Judah in the south, Israel in the north. And Ahab was over Judah, over Israel. He was a wicked king. But he was nothing in comparison to his wife, Jezebel. Jezebel was a piece of work. She was evil. She was flat out evil. She was a foreign woman who imported gods into Israel, and her husband was susceptible to that. And so, really, Jezebel dominated the religious, spiritual landscape of Israel. She brought in the worship of Baal and Asherah. Now, Baal and Asherah were evil, evil false gods. They weren't real, but the spirit of that was quite evil. Among other things, there was sexual immorality involved in the worship practices, and there was child sacrifice involved in the worship of Baal. It was an awful, awful time, and the people of God were buying in and following Baal and Asherah. And so God had said, I'm going to bring judgment. I'm going to bring punishment upon my people. And so through the prophet Elijah, he had Elijah call a drought. So Elijah pronounced a drought in Israel, already an arid climate. And so for 3.5 years, there was a severe drought over the land, and people were really suffering, and so they were starting to call out to God again. And so God said to Elijah, it's time to call off the drought. I'm going to call my people back to repentance. And that story takes place in chapter 18 when Elijah calls Ahab to Mount Carmel, and there's this showdown that takes place. And remember the showdown? Elijah says, okay, look, Ahab, you set your gods up, and I'm going to set my God up, and we're going to offer a sacrifice, but here's the deal. It's the God who answers by fire. That's the real God. It's winner take all. Whoever answers by fire, that is the God that Israel must serve. And you know the story. If you've read it, if you haven't, 1 Kings 18 is a tremendous story. And so, the prophets of Baal, the prophets of Asherah gather together. They are hovered around their sacrifice. There's 800 plus of these prophets. And they cry out all day. They do all kinds of things. They chant. They have incantations, and they're cutting themselves, and they're trying to get the Baal to answer by fire, but nothing happens. And Elijah is mocking them the whole time. It's kind of a funny story. And he's mocking them, and finally he says, look, time's up. My turn now. And he lifts his hands and his eyes toward heaven, and he prays to God, and God comes down and answers by fire and consumes the sacrifice. And not only consumes the sacrifice, God consumes the altar as well and all the water that had been poured over the sacrifice. And there is an amazing demonstration, an undeniable demonstration of the power and the supremacy of God. And all of the people that had gathered there together proclaimed, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. And Elijah said, grab the prophets of Asherah, grab the prophets of Baal, and they put them to death by the sword. They slaughtered 850 of these false prophets. And then the drought was called off, and God sent the rains. Now, that's the context, and so that's what is happening here. So Ahab goes, verse 1, and he tells Jezebel how Elijah had killed all the false prophets. Verse 2, so she sent Elijah a message. May the gods deal with me by this time tomorrow if I don't make you like one of them. In other words, dead. Put to death by the sword. Afraid, Elijah ran for his life. When he got to Beersheba, he left his servant, and he went a day's journey on into the wilderness. Coming to a broom bush, he sat under it, and he prayed that he might die. I've had enough, Lord. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Then he fell asleep under the bush. Suddenly an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. Elijah looked, and nearby was bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. He ate, he drank, and then he slept again. The angel touched him. He said, get up and eat. The journey is too much for you. So he did, and strengthened by the food, he traveled 40 days and nights until reaching Horeb, the mountain of God. There he spent the night in a cave, and the word of the Lord came to Elijah. This is what the Lord said. What are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing here? And Elijah said, Lord, I have been zealous for you, but Israel has rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. And we'll stop there. Elijah, one of the three greatest figures of the Old Testament, one of the two guys that were chosen in the New Testament to meet with Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration, Elijah and Moses. Elijah figures prominently in the prophetic future. Just read about it in Revelation. Elijah, the prophet of fire, the prophet of God, had caught a severe case of the martyr flu. I want you to take note of how his perception got cloudy, because in similar ways, a martyr's view of life gets cloudy. Their perspective gets muddled. And I want you to notice how this happened in Elijah and how it happens for those who are suffering a martyr's complex. So the first thing that we see in verse 3 is fear. Fear. It says, afraid, Elijah ran for his life. Now, isn't that interesting? Elijah has just called down fire from heaven. The fire has consumed the sacrifice. He just has laid waste to the whole ministry, the ministry team of the false prophets. I mean, he is on a roll. He's called off the drought, and the rain has come back to Israel. I mean, this guy is on a roll. And this woman threatens him, and he's suddenly afraid. Which is exactly what fear can do. It can come on us, and it can overtake us, and it can just take the legs out from under us. And we're susceptible to that, and that's why fear not is the most oft-given command in Scripture. They say there are 365 fear nots in the Bible, one for every day of the year, because every day of the year, fear is going to be a problem. It's going to be a challenge. It's going to be a temptation for you and me. It's not problems. It's fear. that is the big enemy that we have. So there was fear. And then verse 3 also says that there was isolation. It says that Elijah left his prophet, his servant in Beersheba, and he went on a day's journey into the desert. He isolated himself. He pulled away at the very time that he shouldn't have. He needed encouragement. He needed his small group around him. He needed encouraging relationships, life-giving, soul-enriching relationships. He separated himself from everybody else. And that then allows things to get more distorted in our lives. And then we see that there was anger. Verse 4, Lord, I've had enough. I've had enough. I think Elijah was angry at two people. He was angry at God, because God didn't do what Elijah expected. And he was angry at the people who had rejected God in spite of all that God had done. There was anger. And then there was negativity in verse 4. Pessimism. Negativity. Verse 4 says, I'm no better than my ancestors. Now what does that mean? What's characteristic of his ancestors? They're dead. He said, I'm as good as dead. I'm dead in the water. You know, they have me dead to rights. I'm dead. I'm as good as dead. I'm no better than my ancestors. Verse 5 says that there was exhaustion. It says he crawled under a bush and he fell asleep. He was physically depleted. That probably contributed to his emotional depletion and his spiritual depletion as well. And so graciously, the Lord allowed him to sleep. Sometimes that's the most spiritual thing you could do. Not right now, but sometimes that's the most spiritual thing you can do. Sometimes a holy thing is just to eat. Now, God has given me a physical constitution where I don't need a lot of sleep. I really don't. I just seem to do better with less. And I can fast for days and it does not affect me. I can fast for a week and go out and run a half marathon and I literally am fine. I just am geared that way. But I have members in my family. One of them, I'm not talking about Linda, by the way, so one of my two daughters. One of my two daughters, if she doesn't get her sleep, she's wrecked. I mean, if she doesn't get the prescribed amount of sleep that she prescribes, she's wrecked. So she kind of plans her life about how much sleep she needs the next night. Or if she didn't get it, she lets you know about it. She needs her sleep. Our other daughter needs her food. And if she doesn't eat at the proper time, she gets shaky and she gets grouchy. And when she was a teenager, we actually took her to a nutritionist, and the nutritionist said, for goodness sake, have food always available in small amounts, eat almonds, nuts, things like that, because it throws your body chemistry out of whack, and then you get out of whack. And sure enough, we began to adjust that, and she turned into a nice person again, our daughter. We thought she was demon-possessed for a while until we figured that out. It wasn't a demon, she just needed food, right? So he was exhausted, and there was some nutritional and rest issues going on there, plus some disappointment. Then verse 10, we find that there was resentment. Verse 10 says, I've been zealous for you, yet Israel has rejected your covenant. There was resentment, deep disappointment. Has God, and I know the answer to this, but has God ever disappointed you? Has God ever not lived up to your agenda for what you think God ought to do? He's not followed your will. He's not answered according to your timing, and you get a little resentful toward God. That was Elijah at this point. And then, and this is the chief characteristic of the martyr. There was exaggeration, distortion. Verse 10 says, I'm the only one that's left. That's the theme song of the martyr. Nobody knows the troubles I've seen. I've been cheated. I've been mistreated. When will I be loved? Exaggeration. I'm the only one that's left. And then, lastly, there was anxiety. Verse 10, anxiety says, they're trying to kill me too. They're trying to kill me. So what's really going on here? What's really going on? Well, and this is typical of the martyr, right? As we're understanding the martyr, this is typical of martyrs. Elijah's focus shifted to three false realities. Let me give you these three. Three false realities. Now, the thing about false realities is they're your reality. Remember, perception is your reality. It could be a wrong reality, a wrong perception, but it becomes what controls your life and your behavior, your way of thinking. So here are three false realities. Here's the first one. Elijah focused on feelings instead of facts. Elijah focused on his feelings, not the facts. Now, I'm not down on feelings. I think emotions are a wonderful thing. God gave us the ability to express emotion, to have feelings. That's from God, okay? But feelings are to be servant, our servant, not our master. And there are a lot of people whose feelings are their master. They respond emotionally. They respond, first of all, they respond out of feelings. They dictate their lives. Their life is dictated by their feelings. Their feelings are their master, not their servant. Elijah got that in reverse too. That's why in verse 4, he prays, I've had it. I might as well die. God, take my life. You know, Elijah, I think, is suicidal. He doesn't want to do it himself. He's too holy for that. So he asked God to. Death by God, right? He's operating out of his feelings. Dr. Steve Pattison said this. I think this is so right on. He says, he calls this the idolatry of feelings. The idolatry of feelings, which is the martyr's sin. When we let our feelings dictate, and at times we all do, right? And that's just the immediate drift that we steer into our feelings, that we have to fight that all the time. If we do that chronically, if we don't get control of that, we will slip into the idolatry of our feelings. So that's the first false reality. Here's the next one. Elijah focused on his circle of concern rather than his sphere of influence. Now this is worth the price of admission today. I hope you'll catch this. In verse 10, he complains that he had done what God had asked him to do, and yet Israel still rejected God's covenant. He says, God, I did my part. You didn't hold up your end of the bargain. Stephen Covey, who has written, the late Stephen Covey, wrote an amazing, amazing book, in my opinion. I don't know what you think about him and about the book, but Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And he talks about this. He says that we have a circle of concern. Notice the graph up there, the figure up there. We have a circle of concern, which is filled with things that we can't control. All of us have that circle of concern. And within that circle of concern, there are some things that we can control, that we can change. And that is what I would call our circle, our sphere of influence. He calls it a circle of influence. I would call it a sphere of influence. There are things that we are concerned about, rightly so, but we can't change them. We cannot change what is happening in the world's environment, the atmosphere. We can't control who is the president. We can't control how the Congress responds to the president. We can't control how hot it's going to be tomorrow, if it's going to rain again tomorrow. We can't control some of those things. We're concerned about them, but they're beyond our control, right? But there are things that we can control, fewer things that we can control, and that is our sphere of influence. Healthy people focus on those. Healthy people focus on their sphere of influence, okay? Elijah was focusing on what only God could do. What only God can do is the circle of his concern. Only God can take care of those things. Rather than focusing on his sphere of influence, which is what God had called him to do. God had given him an assignment. That's what he could do. And he had to leave the rest to God. Focus on your sphere of influence. You can obey God. Only God can change certain things. A martyr will fixate, for instance, on the way people perceive them. That's their circle of concern. Rather than on what they can do to change themselves in order to present a better view to the people in their lives. That is their sphere of influence. In other words, you can only change you. You can't change anybody else. Hopefully people will respond to you in view of how you are changing, how you are growing, how you are becoming better. Hopefully that will happen, but that's not your call. That's your circle of concern. Your sphere of influence is, I can only work on me. Sometimes people will respond correspondingly to how you're growing and you're changing, you're giving effort. Sometimes they won't. Sometimes you can be so Christ-like and it still doesn't impact the way people view you. Sometimes that gets worse, but again, that's out of your control. What you can control is what's inside your circle of your sphere of influence. Okay, so that's what Elijah did. He focused on his circle of concern rather than his sphere of influence. And then here's the last one, last false reality. Elijah focused on the negative, but ignored the positive. The negative became huge in his viewfinder, while the positive just kind of got buried somewhere in the details. He says in verse 10, I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too, Lord. That's why God tried to refocus him. In fact, he did. God refocused him on the positive, on the things that God was doing. God wasn't doing it in the way that Elijah wanted, in the timing that he wanted, but he was still at work, and that's an important principle we'll talk about later on. But I want you to drop down now and look at verses 15 through 18 is kind of the context here, is particularly verses 16 and 17. In essence, what God says to Elijah is, look, Elijah, they're not going to kill you. I know they're trying to, but they're not going to kill you because you are immortal until I say you're not. Every one of us in this room, we are immortal until God says we're not. That means you're untouchable until God says you're not. So, not just in terms of your lifespan, but what happens to you, whether you're promoted or fired, whether you make a good investment or it turns sour, or whether a relationship goes well or not, or someone breaks up with you or unfriends you on Facebook or whatever. You know, that only happens by God's permission. If you believe in a sovereignty, you are immortal on all levels until God says you're not. And in fact, Elijah was always immortal, wasn't he? He was one of two guys in Scripture that never died. I mean, God just said, along with Enoch in the old, you know, the first part of the Bible in Genesis, says God took him. He just said, you know what, you've, for whatever reason, said, look, I'm going to let you escape death, and I'm just going to take you on into my presence without dying. So he was literally immortal until God said he wasn't, and God said, you're never going to be immortal. And then God said, seemed to say to him, look, I still got work for you to do. They're not going to kill you. I still have work for you to do. I've got a mission for you to accomplish. I want you to go here, and I want you to anoint this one. I want you to anoint that one, and I want you to anoint that guy. In other words, I want you to go, and I want you to anoint Hazael, king over Aram, because he is going to bring judgment against Israel. I'm still working out my plan, and Israel hasn't fully repented, so I've got some more work to do, so you go anoint this foreigner to be the king over Aram, because he is going to be the instrument of punishment against Israel. And then I want you to anoint Jehu as king over Israel, because he is going to punish Ahab and Jezebel, because they are wicked, 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 wicked people, and I've got a special punishment for them. And then I want you to anoint Elisha to be your heir apparent. I'm going to bring you back into a life-giving, soul-enriching relationship, and you are going to mentor this prophet, Elisha. And I'm going to give him a double portion of your spirit. I've got plans for him as well. So he refocused him on the mission. That was the positive. And then he said, look, Elijah, quit being a martyr. You're not the only one. I've got 7,000 people, in fact. Now, what is 7,000? You know, 7 is the perfect number, right? It's the number of God. So I don't know that there were literally 7,000 people that were still following God. I think what God is saying is, I've got more people than you can count here that haven't bowed their knee to Baal that still follow me. It's always the case. It's always the case. You might think you're all alone. God has people reserved. You look at our country and you think it's going to hell in a handbasket. Nobody but us serves the Lord. God's got people. God's got people. That's the positive. Don't focus on the negative. Focus on God's positive, okay? So those are the three false realities. So let me give you, a couple of actions, to shift the focus of the martyr within and the martyr without. Remember, we're kind of looking at this as both and. It's me at times, and it's others at times. Sometimes it's chronic in me, sometimes it's chronic in others, and sometimes it's just we just need to be reminded of some things, or we need to remind others of some biblical truth. So let me just give you a couple of actions. For starters, learn to view life through the lens of faith instead of the lens of feeling. These are kind of antidotes to these false realities. Learn to view life through the lens of faith, not the lens of feeling. Picture how God will redeem both the good and the bad as he perfects his plan. By the way, you know what that's called? It's called faith. Hebrews 11:1, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. It's picturing what God is up to. Even though we don't see it in reality, even though we don't know all of the details, we're trusting God. We're saying, God, I trust you with this. It's going to be good. It's going to be okay. You see, there is a point where Romans 8:28 can't just be an old spiritual saw that we quote. It has to be our driving life principle. I mean, Christians are fond of quoting this. You know, God works all things for the good, right? I mean, every Christian knows that. Kind of the corresponding passage is Jeremiah 29:11. I know the plans I have for you, saith the Lord. Plans to bless you and prosper you, give you hope and a future. Read the context of that. It's in some pretty dark times. And Jeremiah is saying, settle down and start looking at what God is doing because he's got a plan and you're going to be okay within this difficult environment. Romans 8:28. In all things, God works good for those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. I think that is so good that we ought to say it together. Every voice. In all things, God works good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. That can't be just a memory verse. It's got to be a driving life conviction that you come back to again and again and again, and you grab your feelings and you shove that fact down the throat of your feelings. Listen, a Romans 8:28 conviction cannot coexist with a martyr complex. If you really believe Romans 8:28, then you cannot be a chronic whiner, complainer, griper, or victim. You can't. It betrays, you know, what your theology really is. When you really believe this, it changes the way you see the world. So let me just suggest this, that you quit looking in the rearview mirror at what did or didn't happen and start looking forward through the windshield of faith. Did you know that a windshield is 100 times larger than your rearview mirror? You ever think about that? There's a reason for that, right? There's a reason for that. God calls us to look forward in faith, not backwards in frustration. You can check it once in a while to see if the police are behind you, but mostly look ahead. Look ahead and envision what God is doing. Practice faith casting. What I call faith casting is spiritual forecasting, and it's good for you. Practice faith casting early and often. When I left Portland Christian Center, I've been spilling the beans on my former churches for several weeks. I might as well do it one more time. Linda said, watching through live stream last week, be careful, don't give too many details. So try to clean it up a little bit today. But I left Portland Christian Center to go to a church in California. How's that for general? I won't mention that it was in Dublin, California. So it was a church in California. And I had been brought in because the church had grown very liturgical, if you will, in its worship style. When I interviewed and got there, it was what I call an Episcopalian Assembly of God church. Very liturgical, very high church, very, you know, and listen, nothing wrong with that, but it was not relating to the community around it very well anymore. And so people were leaving the church, not coming to the church, and so they recognized, we got to change. And so we need a younger pastor. They got me. I was younger. not really, but I was younger than what they had. And my assignment was to come in and to bring some change. And a lot of that change had to do with the worship style, music style. Everybody agreed, we got to change. Everybody loves change. Until it comes to them. Mark Twain also said, the only one who loves change is a wet baby. I found that's true. I found that to be true. And so when I got there, the worship was an organ, the organ-dominated style. You know, just as an aside, when Lucifer got cast out of heaven, he was the chief musician. When he got cast out of heaven, I think he landed on the organ bench. Sorry, not in this church. We had amazing organist, Pastor Ron. She was amazing, right? But I mean, boy, the center of worship wars, we call them in churches, often is the church organist, who is the power broker. Been in several churches now where that's been the case. This was the case here. And we had an organist. It was a fine organist, and she was a power broker within the music department and a power broker within the church. And she had a cohort with her who was the same. And they were very involved in music, the music ministry. And both of their husbands were elders on the church board. And so in order to change the church and give it a different style, I brought in a younger worship pastor. He was amazingly gifted vocally, as a worship leader, as a musician. His wife was a phenomenal pianist. I mean, she was at the same level as our pianist here. Amazing, amazing, amazing. And so we began to change the style of the worship. We needed to, we really did. Well, not long after that, these two ladies, the power brokers, set up a meeting with me. And they came in and they say, look, we're frustrated with this. We don't like what he's doing. We don't like how he runs choir practice. We don't like the songs he's doing. We don't like how he leads us. We just don't like these things. And I said, well, now remember, we agreed that we needed to change, right? Right. I said, so here's what I would suggest that you do. I would suggest that if you have some things that you think can help him, that you tell him that. You talk to him, have a collaborative conversation, and talk about, hey, here's some things that we think could help what you're trying to do. But listen to him, because, you know, he's been called here to help us to change directions. And they went, okay, we'll do that. And so I talked to the pastor. I said, look, expect these ladies to talk to you. Just listen to them, and maybe there's some things that you can take away from that, and let's see what happens, right? I think it's going to be good. Well, a few weeks later, these ladies came back to me, and they said, we told him what we wanted, but he still didn't do what we were asking. I went, oh, you kind of misunderstood what I was saying, and I probably wasn't real gracious, but I said, look, I didn't hire him for you to tell him what he was to do. I hired him to lead you into a new era of worship. So make no mistake about that. He's not here to do everything that you want. He's here to help us to move where God is calling us to go. Boom. Suddenly, the pastor was not the problem. I was Satan's spawn. That week, that was the final straw for these ladies. That week, those two ladies with a third lady and all of their husbands, these elders, left the church. And our business administrator at the time, who wasn't real fond of me either, I inherited him, he came and said, well, congratulations, you just ran off the three top giving families in the church. I don't know the level of giving in that church or this church. I just choose not to do that, but he decided to tell me. And then he went on to tell me how much money was actually walking out the door, and then I got depressed. I had an Elijah experience. I went, Lord, they didn't listen to me, now they're trying to kill me too. And I was having those conversations you have with yourself where you're griping, you're whining, you're crying, you're mad at God because he didn't protect you. You know, you didn't like the way things turned out. You went and you told people something and they still didn't, do what you said. And I was just kind of, I was struggling with this. And then I got a call from the fourth power broker in the church, whose wife was in the choir, in the music department. She was the leader of the bell choir, and we have a bell choir that performs at Christmas. This was a bell choir on steroids. I mean, it was a regular part of our worship services, which is kind of interesting. You have it every Sunday. And so I thought, oh, and she was a strong personality, and her husband kind of, you know, followed whatever she was wanting. And he called me up, and he said, Pastor Ray, he said, I grew up in Fresno, and when I was a kid, I worked in a vineyard. And I learned early on by watching the foreman that during a certain time of the year, he would come in and he would prune the vines back to almost nothing. And it did make sense to me. I thought he was destroying the vines. But he said, we've got to do this in order to produce bigger and better grapes and better, sweeter wine. And then he said to me, you know, sometimes God has to prune his vineyard. He said, do you know what I mean? I went, I know what you mean. And so I accepted that as a part of God's plan. I said, okay, I'm going to focus on the positive. God must be pruning the vineyard to produce something greater in us. And you know what? Then this all took place within this week of them leaving. You know what? That Sunday, guess what? The offerings went up. They didn't go down. And they went up, and they stayed up. And we saw a surge of people come in that very week. Visitors were coming into the church, and there was a different atmosphere. Now, these ladies weren't bad people. They really weren't. They just needed a change of scenery. But they were blocking something of God. And God did me a huge favor. What I saw as a negative was really a positive. And likewise, we have to learn. It's a part of faith casting to see the positive of what God is doing, even though circumstances in the moment may not seem so. And that leads me to the last, the final practice that I want to give you that'll change, that'll shift the focus of the martyr. So look for the positive in every situation. Look for the positive in every situation. Look through the lens of faith, do faith casting, and then look for the positive in every negative. There's a reason why it's not just a good idea to do this, but it's God's idea to do this. And when disappointment comes, we have to practice trust, we have to act in faith, and we need to offer gratitude. That is a winning strategy right there. If you're going to see the positive within the negative circumstances of life, you've got to practice trust that God is in control, obey or act in faith, even when you'd rather retreat and go a different way, and in faith, in advance, offer thanks for what God is doing in your life. God's got a plan, and he will bring it to pass, even when the evidence seems contrary to that. And the scriptural record from beginning to end proves that time and time and time again. God's got an unstoppable plan for his kingdom and for your life. So look for the positive, even if by faith, look for the positive within the negative. Let me close with a story. Tom Menifee was the pastor of St. Luke's Episcopal Church up in Seattle, the Ballard area. And he tells a story of noticing a very high-profile couple sitting in the back row. He spotted them in the last pew of the church. And they were holding their one-year-old son. And he noticed the son was a Down syndrome child. And he could tell from their demeanor that they were embarrassed. They felt awkward. They were embarrassed. They didn't want any attention. In fact, they were sitting in the back. They were hiding out in the back row because they wanted to make a hasty exit, like some of you, when church is over. But on their way out, Pastor Tom intercepted them. He beat them out there like I do sometimes for you. And he got in front of them and he said, follow me. And he led them into his office and he said, have a seat. And they sat down, holding their baby. And he took the baby, the Down syndrome baby, from them. And he held the baby. And he looked into this little baby's eyes. And with tears streaming down his face, he said to the parents, as he looked into the child's eyes, he said for the parents to hear, do you have any idea the gift of God that he has given you in this child? Do you have any idea what a gift God has given you? And he looked up at the parents and he could see that they were hurt and they were confused and they couldn't figure out what he was talking about. And so he said this to them. He said, 2 years ago, my 3-year-old daughter, Sylvia, died with Down syndrome. And so we have 4 other children, and so we know the blessings that kids can be. Yet the most precious gift that we've ever received in our entire lives has been Sylvia. In her uninhibited expression of affection, she revealed to us the face of God like no other human being ever has or ever will. And he said, do you know that several Native American tribes attribute divinity to Down's syndrome children? Because in their utter simplicity, they are a transparent window into the Great Spirit. He handed the child back, and he said to the parents, treasure this child, because he will lead you to the heart of God. From that day forward, Pastor Tom said that the parents began to be proud, to brag about this little one. You practice trust. Act in faith. You give thanks. If you believe in that God, the sovereign, loving God who is always in control, you cannot be a martyr. You cannot be a whiner. You cannot be a complainer. You cannot be a griper. So practice trust, act in faith, and offer thanks. You do that early and often this week. You teach others. You teach your children when you catch them sinking into this woe is me syndrome. When you exhort others, you do that. You do that this week, and you will have built a bridge to God's plan, his gracious, good plan for your life.
Thanks again for listening to this week's edition of the Portland Christian Center podcast. If you want more information about the ministries of Portland Christian Center or have a prayer need, please visit us online at pcctoday.com. Thanks for listening.